The Guardian. The Party is the latest release from The Guardian's virtual reality team.
How are you, Layla?
The film allows the viewer to step into the shoes of a 16-year-old with an autism spectrum disorder, providing a glimpse of what everyday situations, like a birthday party, can feel like to those with a very different experience of social interaction.
Dad!
Everything sounds everywhere now.
People will think that you don't want to talk to them.
Importantly, the viewpoint is that of a female.
Sounds now mixing together, spilling out, spilling in, all around me. Tangled, tinny tumble.
Surprised, it's little wonder. Autism is often discussed in relation to males, and misdiagnosis of autism spectrum disorders with other conditions is more common in females. This week, we ask, why do so many females fall through the diagnostic net? What techniques might they employ to cope with autism? And how can we improve the situation?
Males probably are more vulnerable to autism than females, but we've probably exaggerated the difference in vulnerability between males and females historically because we haven't been identifying females as effectively as we have males.
I'd watch a group conversation starting and I'd look at how everyone spoke, what everyone said. So I'd pick up the right phrases to say at the right given time, and as well as learning how to dress, learning how to kind of move my body when I speak. All those things I learned to pick up from watching other people and how they managed it.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
So is this how radio...
Before we delve into autism spectrum disorders and gender, a bit of background.
Yeah, normally you're kind of dodgy.
Yes, they hide it well there.
And who better to ask than an expert in the field?
Hi, I'm Will Mandy. I'm a clinical psychologist and a senior lecturer at UCL, and I'm an autism researcher.
First question.
I sat down with William in the studio, and I started by asking him what we mean when we discuss autism spectrum disorders.
There's an answer to that question that's kind of written down in diagnostic manuals, like DSM or the European equivalent, the ICD-10, which is that autism is fundamentally diagnosed when there's two types of difficulty. One in the social domain, so difficulties forming relationships, understanding other people's minds, managing body language, that sort of thing. And then there's a kind of non-social element to autism, which is fundamentally about inflexibility, resistance to change, and difficulties with sensory processing. So that's the sort of, if you like, the medical account of what autism is. But I think increasingly, certainly voices within the autism community are challenging that view, and in particular are keen to be defined not just by their difficulties, but by their strengths as well. So, for example, many autistic people have excellent attention to detail, can become very skilled in certain activities by becoming really focused and passionate about it, and also are often rather forthright and honest, and see us neurotypicals as being a little bit hard to read and perhaps a little bit sort of sneaky at times even. So I think, you know, there's an official medical answer to that, which is in terms of difficulties in sociability and flexibility. But I think increasingly we're broadening it out to see autism as a condition that's characterised perhaps as much by certain strengths as by difficulties.
There is, of course, an issue with this phrase spectrum disorder, because it's given rise to a lot of people saying things like, oh, they're a bit on the spectrum, which, of course, it can be a very problematic thing. Can you just talk me through what we mean by this spectrum and what we don't mean by this spectrum as well?
So there's a lot of confusion here. I mean, the first point to make is that until about 20 years ago, there was a general idea that autism was what we call a categorical disorder, something you either have or you don't have. You know, and a good example of a categorical disorder would be Down syndrome. You know, you either have Downs or you don't. We're not all sort of on the Down syndrome spectrum somewhere. What's become increasingly clear that autism isn't like that. It actually represents the extreme of a kind of trait distribution that extends right through the population. Yeah. So I suppose an analogy to that might be high blood pressure. You know, we've all got a kind of blood pressure number somewhere, but when it reaches a certain point, there's a kind of consensus amongst medics that we're going to kind of label that as a clinical syndrome that requires attention. Same with autism. We're all kind of on this dimension somewhere, And above a sort of semi-arbitrary cut point, threshold, those people tend to be labelled as being autistic. So when people say, oh, they're a bit on the spectrum, what they might be referring to is that somebody just has slightly elevated levels of autistic traits, but which aren't in, if you like, above this threshold that might demark somebody who has really quite significant difficulties that require support.
It's historically, the autism spectrum disorder has generally been associated as being sort of a male trait. Is that right? Or is that just the way that we have somehow defined autism?
Yeah, so the answer to that question is still emerging, but I would suggest that it's very likely that males are more vulnerable to autism than females. Yeah.
Why might that be? What's going on there?
That's a tricky question.
Million-dollar question.
So I suppose one idea that's been very influential associated from Simon Baron Cohen is that there's, if you like, that autism represents what they call the extreme male brain. So this idea that, in a sense, males are, if you like, a little bit further along that spectrum in the first place that we talked about before. And so, in a sense, it takes a bit less to sort of nudge them, if you like, over that threshold. Yeah, it's complex and nobody really knows the answer to why males. And in fact, it's very interesting that males are more vulnerable to a whole range of neurodevelopmental problems. You know, ADHD, Tourette's, there's something about being male that makes you more vulnerable to these disorders that of onset in early childhood. Whereas females tend to be more vulnerable to conditions of adolescent onset. The point I wanted to make is that males probably are more vulnerable to autism than females, but we've probably exaggerated the difference in vulnerability between males and females historically because we haven't been identifying females as effectively as we have males. And that is almost certainly because there is, if you like, a kind of a more female typical presentation of autism that is distinct from, let's just call for convenience, a male typical presentation. But our current consensus about autism, our definition of it, the way we diagnose it, reflects the male presentation of autism and therefore is more likely to miss female typical cases.
So fewer females fit that male pattern, therefore they go under the radar, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And I would just like to offer a proviso. There's always a risk in these conversations of falling into a men are from Mars, women are from Venus position.
Yes.
And so I'm going to try not to talk in that way, but I might occasionally, for a shorthand, if I say, you know, females, autistic females are like this, autistic males are like that, I'm just talking about tendencies.
Can be a lot of overlap.
There's plenty of overlap. Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about kind of tendencies for autistic females to be more like this and tendencies for autistic males to be more like that.
So it's not cut and dried is the point here.
It's not cut and dry. That's right.
But, as William alludes to, differences do exist when it comes to typical presentation in females and males. And according to William, the diagnostic criteria used for autism has historically been skewed towards the typical male presentation.
Hello.
Hi, Hannah.
Hiya.
This is Hannah Belcher.
I'm Hannah Belcher and I'm a PhD student at Anglia Ruskin University.
Hannah was diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder at the age of 23. I spoke to her down the line and started by asking her what it was like growing up.
Just talk me through what your experiences as a child were like. Did you have particular things which made you feel that you were perhaps experiencing things a little differently from others around you?
So when I was a child, I had a lot of problems regulating body temperature and things like that. I was very sensitive to things like lights, sounds, tastes, that kind of thing. And I was selectively mute up until the age of about 6, I think. So I had all these signs that something wasn't quite right. But I made friends at school and I seemed to fit in okay. So actually, I didn't even consider that there was a problem until I dropped out of school at about 14. I remember my childhood being quite stressful and I remember being very anxious. And not really understanding why I was constantly so anxious, but not really realising there was a problem or that I was different to other people probably until late teenage years.
And when you started to feel that way, did you start developing any techniques to try to kind of cope with that, or was it a case that those differences just became more and more apparent to you?
I think I'd always been using coping mechanisms. I realised when I found out about autism that my whole life I'd been learning to socially mimic other people, and I just assumed that everyone did this, which they do to a certain extent, but not possibly as much as I was doing it. So that was something that I that I learned how to do. And I think the differences for me was when I started realising that my friends were kind of growing up wanting to go to parties and be with boys and things. And I just found it all too anxiety provoking. I didn't want to change my friendship group. I didn't want to meet new people. I didn't really want to go out with all these people. And that's when I started to think I'm not quite fitting in the same way anymore.
When you talk about the mimicking techniques, just talk me through what you mean by that when we talk about social mimicking. What sort of things were you doing?
So usually as we grow up, we learn how to socially mimic other people. That's a very natural thing to do. But for women with autism and for myself as well, it's kind of, I would monitor and look at how people react in certain situations. So I'd read a lot of non-fiction books, fiction books. I'd watch a lot of documentaries, films, and I'd be looking for how everyone behaved. So, for example, I'd watch a group conversation starting and I'd look at how everyone spoke, what everyone said. So I'd pick up the right phrases to say at the right given time. And as well as learning how to dress, learning how to kind of move my body when I speak, all those things I learned to pick up from watching other people and how they managed it.
It sounds like a really energy-consuming thing to be doing. Did you find it had an impact on sort of how you felt in other ways as well?
Yes, I didn't quite appreciate how exhausting it was, I don't think, until I got to the age of 14 and I dropped out of school because I was just so exhausted. I was ill all the time. And now I find if I have too many social situations, I perform very well in them, but I'm really exhausted for maybe a week or two afterwards. And it really significantly impacted my mental health as well. So I've had a lot of problems with anxiety and depression, which I think comes from constantly having this social awareness, this social anxiety, and having to mould myself constantly into where I need to be fitting.
For years, Hannah lived with these mental health issues. But it wasn't until much later that she received a diagnosis of autism. I asked her what her path to diagnosis was like.
Yes, it's quite a stressful path. I dropped out of school. I was home tutored. I didn't leave the house possibly for about a year solidly, and then after that would gradually be able to go to like doctor's appointments or to the post box and things like that. And then I finished my GCSEs, which I studied at home for, and I decided to go to college, which I managed to go to about one day a week, I think, but the rest, again, I was home tutored. Went to university, actually. I went to University of York, where, again, I was mostly housebound to my flat, but I made a lot of friends who helped me out. I suffered really badly from depression and anxiety. Those were the main problems at that point. And so when I finished university, I ended up seeing an art therapist, and she suggested that she thought I might have autism, which is then when I first heard about it, when I first looked into it, because I studied it for my dissertation, but I'd never considered that a female like myself could have it, because all we ever really study is very male stereotypical. So then, yeah, I pushed for the diagnosis, and I got diagnosed by Simon Baron Cohen's team in Cambridge.
It was following this diagnosis that Hannah decided to delve deeper by undertaking a PhD into something that she had experienced on a personal level. We'll hear more about that after this short break.
There's a lot of books, there's a lot of online resources now of females coming forward and saying that they've experienced the same problems, but nothing is in the literature, which is why we still keep getting this very male-biased view of what autism is.
We'll also hear how this dearth of research goes beyond autism.
This whole field, I think, resonates with broader issues of neurodiversity, you know, and this idea that we need to find a way to be more respectful and to give more opportunities to people who are neurodiverse.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, it attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, be sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard from autism researcher William Mandy about how the criteria used to diagnose autism spectrum disorders might be skewed towards a typical male presentation, meaning that females on the autism spectrum might be misdiagnosed with other conditions or be missed altogether. It's something Hannah Belcher knows all too well, and something she mitigated with what are known as camouflaging techniques, which include social mimicking.
And so talk me through,
Having only received a diagnosis at 23, Hannah now hopes to try and increase awareness of this issue, starting with her PhD thesis.
I'm studying at Anglo-Ruskin University, which is in Cambridge, and I'm looking specifically at the area of misdiagnosis in females with autism, and also the use of social mimicking as a social strategy for how they may hide impairments. And the reason I decided to do that was because when I learned about my own diagnosis, I realised actually there wasn't any research actually looking at the problem. There's a lot of books, there's a lot of online resources now of females coming forward and saying that they've experienced the same problems, but nothing is in the literature, which is why we still keep getting this very male-biased view of what autism is.
And when you talk about misdiagnosis, I mean, what sort of things is autism in females misdiagnosed as?
So some of the most common things are other mental health conditions. So something like anorexia, borderline personality disorder, anxiety conditions, OCD, which all also commonly are comorbid with autism. So sometimes splitting the two off can be quite difficult. And I think often is the case that if a female presents to a psychiatrist, that they will more likely select the condition that is more commonly seen in that population. So they'll more commonly think it's a mental health condition rather than even consider that it might be autism.
With people on the autism spectrum often seen as having an extreme male brain, something I wanted to know was how social expectations affect females with such conditions.
In those anxieties between men.
William Mandy again.
One theme that we found talking to autistic women was some of them almost felt that, you know, on the one hand, you've got the cultural expectations that they felt were placed on them as a woman. You know, perhaps a pressure to take on roles such as girlfriend or wife or mother. And on the other hand was their autism and what that sort of led them to want to do and want to be. And they felt that those were very incompatible and that actually there was something especially challenging about being female and autistic in our culture because they felt their autism led them into places to want to occupy roles that didn't fit comfortably with what was expected of them as women. There's also another interesting angle to this, which is that quite a few autistic women prefer the company of men than of women. Not all, of course. I don't wish to overgeneralize, but some of the autistic women we've spoken to about this have said that they find all female groups more subtle and perhaps less forgiving of kind of faux pas and things like that compared to masculine groups that they find themselves in, where they've reported they find there's a bit more kind of overtness in some of the communication. So there's a whole intriguing aspect to this, which is about the scenarios, the situations that women are expected to operate in, the rules they're expected to operate by, and how being autistic can really challenge that.
Yeah, it can be difficult, and I think one of the reasons that females have learnt this strategy is because from a young age, we're taught to be polite, sociable. So for a young girl that's showing those sort of traits of autism, like a young boy would, they're being told by parents, by friends, that that's not normal, that they need to behave differently. Whereas those sort of traits are accepted to a much higher degree in boys generally. And then there's another problem, I think, where not all females with autism present in this social mimicking way. Some of them also do have very stereotypical behaviours. So I think it's possibly not helpful to genderise the condition at all. And I know a lot of males as well who also socially mimic and have mental health conditions for the same reasons, and that they don't present in a very male stereotypical way for being an autistic individual. So I think it can present itself in many different ways, regardless of gender.
Perhaps this touches on a broader issue then, that goes beyond autism.
is this sort of another call to arms to tackle gender stereotypes, to break down that inflexibility that seems to be so pervasive, to make it a safer and easier place for people not only of different genders, but also people with different neuroprofiles to feel safe and comfortable as well?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that this whole field, I think, resonates with broader issues of neurodiversity, you know, and this idea that we need to find a way to be more respectful and to give more opportunities to people who are neurodiverse, as you say, not just with autism, and to males as well as females. You know, I often think we live in a very, very strict culture, essentially. You know, if I took an arbitrary decision to shake nobody's hand for the next 6 months, I just wouldn't do it. I'd probably get in a lot of trouble. You know, there'd be all sorts of situations where I'd really alienate people.
Yeah.
You know, just a tiny little deviation from normal social behaviour. I'd have to really bring to bear all my social skills to try and manage the impact of that. So imagine what it's like if you're autistic and there are all sorts of social rituals that you either don't really get or you don't want to do them and so on. You know, we're very intolerant of that culturally. And I think it would be lovely to if we could change that. Because again, you know, in our work, the number one reason for camouflaging is to avoid bullying and victimization. You know, so you kind of have a situation perhaps analogous to being gay, you know, in the 1960s or 70s, where people felt, and before, obviously, where people felt they had to pass, was often the phrase. You had to pretend not to be gay for fear of the consequences. And currently we have a situation where autistic people have to pretend not to be autistic for fear of the consequences. So, it would be lovely if we could become a little bit more flexible ourselves rather than going on at autistic people for being inflexible. Perhaps the neurotypical world become a bit more flexible about the range of behaviours that we consider appropriate.
Moving forward, I wanted to know what can now be done to address these issues, both within the world of autism spectrum disorders and beyond. First up, Hannah Belcher.
I think more research has to be done on the population. I think too much research has focused on that early diagnosed group that was shaped by the literature that was there. So I think a lot more work needs to be put into that. And I think clinicians, doctors, professionals need to have training on autism to understand the different ways it can present and the different challenges that those individuals present with. I think that's the main thing. I think generally people just need to keep an open mind. It's a condition that has many different ways of manifesting itself. So I think it's important for everyone to understand the kind of neurodiversity of all of us.
Sentiments shared by William Mandy.
There's a couple of things. I think we need to have a better scientifically based understanding of female typical autism. You know, we're still at quite early days in this field. So the way it's been, there's been a lot of very rich information coming from autistic women, coming from clinicians. The scientists, we're almost trying to catch up now by actually testing out those ideas empirically. So over the next 10 years, I think we'll build up a pretty good body of knowledge about the female autism presentation. And that will be helpful because that can then feed into modification of diagnostic criteria, modification of diagnostic instruments. But I think the other thing is awareness. Yeah, totally. Again, the young girl who's brought by her mum to the GP, you know, who's maybe school refusing, anxious, very picky eater, has one best friend but really struggles when that friend is away. You know, they should be thinking not just is this separation anxiety, is this social anxiety, but also, oh, I wonder if this could be autism. You know, so if that awareness is out there, if people then start asking the question, I think we've got a much better chance of picking up people's difficulties earlier.
Special thanks this week to William Mandy and Hannah Belcher. To watch the party, head over to theguardian.com/VR, where you'll also find details on how to download the new Guardian Virtual Reality app. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our new email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.